Disc 3.
It was Friday night, and I was at home putting together the things I'd need for the weekend trip to Porterville with the Mongols. I had just gotten off the phone with my kids. I tried to explain to them that I had to work this weekend and that I wouldn't get to see them for a few days. It was very hard for them to understand. My youngest son was going to baseball practice, and I wanted to be there, but this Porterville run was an opportunity to make serious progress in the investigation, an opportunity I couldn't afford to pass up. My girlfriend was becoming annoyed that my nights and weekends were now the sole property of the Mongols. She was feeling left out of my life, and I didn't blame her. My new full-time companion was the investigation. As I packed, I tried to explain to her how important it was that I seized the opportunities as they presented themselves. She really couldn't see it from my perspective, and I suppose I couldn't see things from hers. "Look, I gotta do what I gotta do," I said, and we didn't say another word to each other the rest of the night. I was up early Saturday morning, said a terse goodbye, fired up the bike and headed for Tujunga. It was a gorgeous Southern California day, and as I breezed down the freeway, I found myself looking forward to the run. I met up with the San Fernando Valley chapter in front of the place, and we hit the highway. Porterville is a 14-square-mile agricultural community about 165 miles north of Los Angeles. It's a little less than the halfway point between Los Angeles and San Francisco, at the base of the Sequoia National Park. The campground there was one of the Mongols' favorite spots for a down-home run. There was nothing special about it as far as campgrounds go, at least not until 150 outlaw bikers rolled in and took it over. Pulling into the campground, I'd seen a flatbed trailer that had been parked at one end. Domingo grinned, greeted me with a high five, and told me that we were going to have a good time tonight. He left it at that, and I knew better than to ask questions. A little later, an uninvited guest came stumbling into the Mongols' camping area. Just your standard, run-of-the-mill, white trash drunk who was about to learn a lesson in Mongol respect. He was told that he was in an area that belonged to the Mongols. After he refused to leave promptly, several hulking Mongols administered a severe beating and stomping. Sporting a bruised ego and two newly acquired black eyes, the drunk finally realized it was in his best interest to leave the campground. As the sun went down and the music and barbecue were fired up, I managed to get back into the groove with the assistance of a few beers. Rocky and I walked around visiting several other chapter campsites. Rocky introduced me as a new hangaround. With reserved enthusiasm, others welcomed me. Some hours after dark, and after we had eaten, the SFV chapter guys moved over to the flatbed entertainment area where the rest of the Mongol nation had assembled. Loudspeakers blared rock music, and lights were trained on the flatbed. Domingo punched me hard to get my attention, his typical Mongol tactic. He pointed to five or six half-naked girls walking up onto the flatbed. Young, sexy, and in good shape, they moved to the music, taking off what little clothes they had on. Unlike the strippers in regulated exotic dance clubs, these girls didn't stop at G-strings. When they were stark naked, they recklessly invited Mongols to participate in the show. Suddenly, I heard Domingo yell to one of the strippers, "Baby, I want you to sit on my butt's face." Domingo was waving a $5 bill at the stripper, which was like waving a steak at a hungry tiger. She ran over and snatched the five out of his hand. He turned around, grabbed me by my shirt, literally picked me up and threw me onto the stage, where I landed on my back. With one giant step, the nude girl stood over me. I heard a loud cheer go up from the Mongol crowd. In that instant, I thought about ATF administration, the U.S. Attorney's Office, my already pissed-off girlfriend, my by-the-book case agent, and the possibility of an internal affairs beef. The roar of the crowd was the stripper's cue. Shaking and writhing to the music, she bent down on her knees and buried my face in her crotch. As she moved back and forth, I could hear louder cheering from the crowd. After a few seconds, she stood up. I took a much-needed breath of air. Domingo pulled me from the stage before I could even stand up. I gathered myself and, like a victorious prizefighter, thrust my fist into the air while still tasting the stripper on my lips. "Billy!" The Mongols cheered and patted me on the back. Less than a minute went by before the Mongols were again completely fixated on the naked strippers on the stage. I made my way through the crowd looking for a place to spit. I watched as the Mongols got wilder and more aggressive with the strippers. Inevitably, the grabbing and clawing got too much for the girls, who partnered up with their first tricks, and the show was over. When the sun woke me a few hours later, I had a paralyzing headache. Not just an ordinary bad morning after. This was a world-class hangover. Holy shit! I heard myself groaning into the ground. I'm gonna have to get better just to die. If this was the pace the investigation was going to take, I wasn't sure I'd live to see the end. Around 11, Domingo got up and announced that we would be going up to Visalia to finish partying with our Sen Cal brothers, the Central California chapter. Jesus, that was not at all what I wanted to hear. I was seriously hurting. It must have been around 2 p.m. when the SFV and Sen Cal chapters headed out for Visalia. There was no way that I could make contact with Chacon to let him know the change of plan. He would just have to continue his surveillance and follow the pack. I wondered if he was still in the game. It didn't take long to make that determination. At the first stoplight I came to, I looked in my rearview mirror only to see the whites of Chacon's eyes. He was so close that he could have been a chick sitting on the back of my bike. I wondered who else might be noticing him and his ridiculous proximity. I made a mental note to tell him at a later debrief that he needed to work on some of his surveillance techniques. It was early, though. We'd all learn a few things during this investigation. We rolled into Visalia and went to the residence of the Sen Cal chapter president. I was dog-tired. But so were Rocky and Rancid. We found beds, couches, and floorboards, anything to lie out on and catch some sleep. Only half awake, I observed constant traffic coming in and out of the house. The Sen Cal chapter president was a pretty prolific cocaine dealer. Another thing that kept me awake was all the talk of gun trafficking that went on until well into the afternoon. I couldn't act like I was listening too closely, so I lay there with my eyes closed, trying to memorize the various makes of guns the Mongols were discussing for the ATF report I'd have to type up when I got home. Finally, Domingo and the Sen Cal chapter president decided it was time to hit a few of the local bars. Among the Mongols, showering and teeth brushing weren't even a consideration. Rocky slapped me on the shoulder. He was good to go. Rancid was altogether another story. Nothing short of a cold bucket of water or Armageddon was going to move him off his lazy, smelly ass. Domingo decided to go with the cold bucket of water, and finally, with a shudder and profane shout, Rancid stirred to life. I accompanied about a dozen Mongols to a Visalia bar. Domingo began taking some heat about me from the Sen Cal guys. I watched as his demeanor toward me changed. Every little thing I did now became a big problem for Domingo. I went to the bathroom. He questioned me about where I'd been. I went to call my girlfriend. He questioned me about who I'd been talking to. Then he locked me in a mean stare. "I'm keeping an eye on you, Billy." At about 10 o'clock, after intimidating the bar manager out of a few hundred bucks worth of unpaid-for beer, Domingo approached me and said that we were going over to an associate's place to hook up with some strippers. I could only imagine what this might mean. Was this going to be some kind of new test for the hang-around? Mongols downed their remaining booze and headed for the door. As I made my way outside, I looked for Chacon and the guys, with Domingo hovering over me, I couldn't chance more than a quick glance up and down the street. I didn't see anything remotely resembling a cop car. Reality hit me hard. I'd lost all backup now. It was just my wits against these cranked-up, alcohol-fueled outlaws. We left the bar and made our way through the streets of Visalia until we arrived at a small house. I had no idea who lived there. Domingo said that the SENCAL president was going to put in a phone call to the girls, and that they would be over in a little bit. I began to wonder just what this was going to turn into. After a few more beers, Domingo disclosed the real plan for the evening's festivities. He said that the girls had been told that they would be coming over to give a private dance show for the Mongols, for which they would be paid handsomely. He smiled as he told me what was really going to happen. We would tie them up and gangbang them all before heading back to L.A. "Great idea," I said, smiling back at Domingo. Inside, I tried to stifle a wretch at the thought of premeditated kidnapping and gang rape. I tried my damnedest to mask the panic in my face. I had to think of a way to get out of this one. I looked around. I had no idea exactly where I was. I had no idea where Chacon or the backup guys were. I had no gun with me. It was too risky at that point of the investigation to take the chance of the Mongols finding it on me. But I knew that several of the Mongols were carrying firearms, and all the dope the Mongols had consumed wasn't making the situation any better. No one was going to come to their senses. After about an hour of pacing, frantically wondering what I should do, I was approached by the kid, Karina's old man, and the president of the Riverside County, or RIVCO, chapter. The kid was a hardcore outlaw, a major league asshole, and about as predictable as a rabid wolverine. He had gotten out of prison for a felony drug conviction a few months before, and was back at the helm of the RIVCO chapter, partying like a man desperate to make up for all those lost years. The kid clearly didn't trust me. He looked directly into my eyes and said, "You do nose candy, Billy?" "What?" "Do you do nose candy?" I stared at him blankly. "Cocaine, Billy," he snapped. "Do you do fucking cocaine?" "Yeah, sometimes. But I ain't doing shit tonight." "How come?" "It's hard enough for me to keep up with y'all. Jesus, you're half my fucking age. All this beer and coke, too, that's gonna knock me on my ass." The kid began to push methamphetamine as an all-purpose pick-me-up. "Crank will keep you going, Billy. What you need to do is a few lines of crank." Domingo walked up, nodding. "Yeah, Billy, you want to do some crank." It was unheard of for Domingo to push the dope issue. For one thing, he didn't touch drugs himself. He was still on parole, had only recently come out of prison on an assault charge, and had to pass a weekly piss test with his parole officer. I began to feel the heat of Domingo's stare. A premeditated gang rape, and now a dope test. It was going from bad to worse. I looked around to see several other Mongols watching hard for my reaction. Gangs like the Mongols have been in the cops and robbers game for so long, they know the signs to look for in someone they suspect of being an undercover. You can't just pull some excuse out of your ass without having your corroboration in place. If I'd gone the Domingo route, "Hey, I gotta take a piss test from my parole officer every week," then they'd want to know my PO's name, which prison I'd done my time in, and who my cellmate was. The Mongols have plenty of sources in both the federal and state prisons systems and could punch holes in that story in short order. If I said I had to take a random drug test for my job, then they'd soon have their private eyes checking out that story. Few real companies are willing to back an undercover operation of this nature. And while we found one that would, they could not withstand intense questioning on the minutia of drug testing, and I would have been reckless to put them in that position. The kid walked a few feet away and laid out a couple of lines of methamphetamine on a car hood. Then, loud enough for everyone to hear, he yelled, "Get your ass over here, Billy. Do a line, or we aren't ever going to believe anything you say." I could feel my face getting bright red. I was boxed into a corner, and I knew I had to fight my way off the ropes, but I'd done my homework. I'd studied the way Kaz had improvised his way out of similar jams when he was undercover with the Vagos. Rather than back down, I yelled angrily back at the kid, "You don't believe any fucking thing I say anyway, motherfucker! I'm not going to pile my bike into some tree because I did some shit just to make you guys happy. I'll be lucky to get back to L.A. as it is, so fuck you!" They were all speechless. Hangarounds don't talk that way to full patches, and they definitely don't talk that way to chapter presidents. I figured the least I'd get away with would be an ass-whipping, but it might give me a good excuse to jump on my bike and leave before the strippers got there for the gang rape. To my astonishment, the kid laughed. "More for me," he said, and snorted up both lines. Everybody else laughed, too. The hours crept by, until it was around 3 a.m. The strippers still hadn't shown up. Just about all the Mongols were too stoned and drunk to focus on anything. Finally, Domingo said, "Fuck it." He was ready to head back to L.A. As exhausted as I was, I fully understood that the planned gang rape was meant to be my biggest test yet. If I hadn't participated, I would have been out of the Mongols. Of course, as a cop, as a father, as a human being with a conscience, participation wasn't a question. But what could I have done? If I tried to stop the rapes, I'd blow my cover and risk getting killed when they realized who I was. Without a gun, without backup, there was no way one cop was going to be able to stop a dozen rapist Mongols flying high on meth and coke. But Lady Luck smiled on me. And she smiled on those strippers, too. The Mongols had lost interest in testing me. Without any great fanfare, they fired up the bikes. I glanced around the block again. Chacon and the boys were still nowhere in sight. I was beyond tired. I'd slept about 3 hours in the last 48. If I made it home alive, that would be a victory as far as I was concerned. We rode mile after mile until the sun came up. It was about 5 a.m. when we finally hit the Tohunga area, and my weary head was filled with thoughts of the Mongols luring those unsuspecting dancers into a trap of kidnapping and rape. Chapter 7. By the summer of 1998, I'd become an official Mongols prospect. As a probationary member of the gang, a prospect is trusted with more responsibilities than a hangaround, but he also has a lot more at stake. By now, I'd been educated in the basic club hierarchy, had begun to master the outlaw traditions and codes. Official club meetings are known as church. The club had its bylaws and constitution, as well as its own twisted version of the biblical laws of Moses, which I ultimately received from Domingo and which was vouchered as evidence. The 5 Mongol Commandments. 1. A Mongol never lies to another Mongol. 2. A Mongol never steals from another Mongol. 3. A Mongol never messes around with another Mongol's old lady. 4. A Mongol never causes another Mongol to get arrested in any way, shape, or form. 5. A Mongol never uses his patch for personal gain. If you intend to break any of the above commandments, you might as well turn our patch in now or face the consequences. In order to become a prospect, I had to complete an official Mongol's application. I was a little stunned when Rocky handed it to me one day at his house. It was 3 pages long and more intense and personal than applications I'd filled out to become a law enforcement officer. The Mongols wanted to know everything from your social security number to how long your dick was. But I stood there nodding at Rocky, acting unfazed. "No problem, my man. I'll get it back to you in a day or so." Meanwhile, I could quickly see that we had a major problem. We might even have to deep six the whole operation. For one thing, Rocky told me that after I filled out the application, it was going to be handed over to a private investigator, quite possibly an ex-cop. I also knew that sometimes the best you can do is not good enough. I had started building my undercover background as Billy St. John in the mid-80s, during my work inside the neo-Nazis, the National Alliance, and other anti-government groups. ATF had the ability to do anything any other federal or local agency could do as far as covering their UC agents, such as creating a bogus arrest record, work history, credit reports, vehicle registration, driver's license, and educational records. In preparing my undercover identity, I had been in touch with other agents and agencies who were in the know about potential pitfalls. I had called on my old friend Steve Campbell, a police department captain in North Carolina, who set up a bogus criminal record for me. It showed several misdemeanor arrests for assault and drug violations. I was one of the few guys at ATF who was able to actually go under with some confidence, at least until I saw that Mongol membership application. I was scanning the questions and thinking, how the hell are we going to cover all this shit? There was no way I could do it alone. If Chacon wanted his UC agent to stay alive, he was going to have another project dumped in his lap. Once again, Chacon saved my skin. He proved himself a genius at navigating the complex and often treacherous administrative waters of ATF. We made a great team that way. John handling the behind-the-scenes machinations of the Bureau, and me handling the face-to-face stuff with the bad guys on the street. Within a few hours of seeing my application, Chacon had a team of ATF agents running from one side of the country to the other, getting things in place to bolster my background. Besides the obvious ID issues, Social Security number, California driver's license, Veterans Administration records, the Mongols wanted telephone numbers and addresses from my relatives. They expected to see high school records, in my case, from North Carolina in the late 1960s. They also wanted to see hard copies of W-2s for 5 years. In just a matter of days, Chacon pulled it all together. He had ATF agents inside the school system in the town where I'd supposedly grown up, doctoring official school records for me. He had various agents around the country ready to answer the phone numbers we provided, pretending to be my parents, uncles, aunts, cousins. He got his hands on IRS forms and made some official W-2s proving that Billy St. John had worked at a California-based avionics company for the past 5 years. The avionics industry deals with aircraft instrumentation, radar units, navigational radios, weather scopes, altitude indicators, and speed indicators. My job was to buy and sell used equipment. During the day, I would pick up equipment in Southern California and take it to a real repair shop. And to give the whole employment cover more credibility, on several occasions, I arranged to bring one of the Mongols with me on a pickup. A few times, I even took Rocky along to meet with my supposed employer, actually an ATF agent working undercover, so he could pay me in front of Rocky. We felt like we had covered everything that the Mongols were asking for in the application, and we were sure as fuck betting my life on it. But as thorough as we'd been in preparing my background, I was still a nervous wreck every day I went in to meet the Mongols, and Chacon was just as wound up and tense as I was. Following protocol, I turned my application in to our chapter president, Domingo. There was no backing out of it now. Despite my apprehensions, I had to maintain that level of outward confidence, aggression, and surliness that's expected from men in the world of one percenters. I couldn't let the possibility of being found out overshadow my performance. If I ever appeared too nervous or jumpy, the Mongols would read it instantly as weakness and sniff me out as a cop, or at least as a guy pretending to be someone he wasn't. For weeks, as I fired up my Harley, I kept talking to myself, "Hey, Billy, chill out. They like you. If they didn't, they wouldn't have asked you to join the club. If they really thought you were a cop, they'd have fucked you up a long time ago." Plus, I didn't have any solid evidence against Domingo or Rocky or Rancid, and therefore I told myself they had no reason to kill me, even if they did find out who I really was. Of course, that was the logical analysis, and didn't take into account the irrational, hot-headed, and often psychotic behavior I knew that members of the Mongols were capable of. I kept up the ritual for the next couple of weeks. I get myself good and psyched up, ride into Tohunga on my hog, hang out with the Mongols, buy beer for them, and shoot pool. We would ride to an event or another bar, and Rocky, my designated mentor, would teach me some more time-honored Mongol tradition. I checked the guys' faces and demeanor each time I met with them. I tried to catch any tiny nuances or ticks that might signal that I was in trouble. Then, one lazy mid-morning, I was hanging out at my UC pad when I got an unsettling call from Rocky. "Hey, Billy," he said, "why don't you come on over?" It wasn't a request, it was a command. But it didn't sound like Rocky. His voice was distant, suspicious, spacey. "What's going on, Rock?" In a long, drawn-out way, completely out of character, he said, "Just come on over here, dude. We're gonna go and pick up your colors. We gotta go see Bobby Loco first, then we're going to Luna's place and pick up your colors, so come on over." I didn't know quite what to say. I knew that Bobby Loco was the Mongol who was in charge of checking out the background information in my application. Luna was the Mongol's national secretary treasurer, a very high-ranking officer within the organization. Both men were patched in with the mother chapter, which was down in Commerce. Bobby Loco and Leno Luna were old-timers, veterans from the days of the original war with the Hell's Angels, and as hardcore as they come. As a prospect, you are entitled to wear the rudimentary colors of the club. You are allowed to wear the leather vest with Prospect on the front and a lower rocker that reads California on the back. Eventually, having proven yourself by engaging in criminal activities like hauling drugs and guns, and after a unanimous vote by the chapter membership, you can earn the right to a center patch of the club's official logo. But you could never wear the coveted top rocker, the Mongol's patch, until you were a full-fledged member of the club. When Rocky mentioned getting my colors, I was taken aback. I knew I wasn't scheduled to be picking up any colors and figured Domingo would have mentioned it to me if I had. As Rocky droned on in his spaced-out voice, I began to fear that what I'd really be picking up was a bullet in the back of my head. Still, I couldn't stall Rocky without raising suspicions. I told him to hang in there. I'd be over in a bit. "Get on the stick," he said, then abruptly hung up. I dialed Chacon right away. "John, I just got a call from Rocky."
"Yeah? What's up with Big Rock?"
"Some weird shit. He's acting really strange. He says he wants me to come over, says we're gonna go pick up my colors. It doesn't sound right to me. It sounds like they may have found out something. I don't like it, John. I don't like this shit at all." John respected my intuition and knew that the call under these circumstances would be up to me. I went back over the last couple of days in my mind, looking for something that might have given me away. I couldn't think of anything. Neither could John. We kept bouncing scenarios past each other on the phone. What little mistake might I have made? Chacon was thinking a bit more clearly than I was. "Billy, it might not be anything at all," he said. "We just don't know." We hadn't gotten any phone calls from any of our background people. We knew the Mongols were looking at me hard, but so far, so good. The club's private investigator had so far turned up only what we'd wanted him to turn up. He had run a credit check and turned up my UC credit report. He'd contacted my supposed relatives with some questions and was satisfied. He'd contacted school officials in North Carolina who were played by ATF agents. He'd contacted my supposed avionics company and verified my employment there. The one hitch occurred when he ran my driver's history with the California Department of Motor Vehicles. And even though my bike and my UC car were registered to Billy St. John, it didn't list a motorcycle endorsement under that name. The endorsement meaning I could legally ride a bike rather than just drive a car was on my real driver's license. Luckily, the Mongols figured it to be a typical DMV fuck-up. I wasn't sure what was up with Rocky today, but something was. I didn't have to go see him. I could just tell John that this was the end of the road. The case would be over, but I'd still be alive. No one could fault me. The UC always has a last word in these situations. I'd been through some tight places, a lot tighter than this, and come out alive. I could do it. As a prospect, I didn't carry a gun. I didn't wear a wire, That could have been suicidal, given the constant scrutiny I was under. I never wanted too many agents following me around, because they could do more harm than good. But this time, I'd put it all on the line. I'd go in armed. I'd wear a wire. I'd get the best backup the L.A. Division had to offer. If it was a setup, I'd be ready for it. I'd take the Mongols on in their own backyard. I told Chacon that besides Carr, Kaz, and Hardin, I wanted Chuck Pratt and Mike Dawkins there. Pratt and Dawkins were both proven gunfighters and good friends of mine. I had no doubt they would all risk their lives to save mine. Chacon would roll by Rocky's place on surveillance, and if he saw any of the known Mongol gunslingers there, Red Dog, Woody, Diablo, or Lucifer, we'd call it off. If it looked like no one other than Rocky was there, I would go in. If I was met with a gun, I'd shoot first and ask questions after my backup entered and cleaned up. Chacon agreed. I even thought about wearing a vest, but that would clearly give me away. I had to calm down. I had to take the risk and make the best of it. The plan was set. I knew what I had to do. I picked up my 5-shot revolver, wondering if 5 shots would be enough today. I tucked the gun in the pocket of my jacket, where I'd have my hand when I walked into Rocky's place. I thought back to undercover deals that had turned into shootouts. I'd seen more than my share of that kind of action, and I had listened to tapes of undercover deals that had gone bad, where cops had been shot, and you could hear them breathe their last breath. It weighed heavy on me as I fired up and rolled out to meet Chacon. John had rallied the troops. Everybody that I wanted was there on backup. Guys I had put my life on the line for. Guys I trusted. Guys who would make this op easier. Chacon told me they were gathering near Rocky's place and putting together their plan. I felt better as I taped the wire to my leg. The backup team had checked out the target location. There were no other cars or bikes at Rocky's place. Chacon and I both understood that we were about to roll the dice on the biggest stakes so far in this investigation. I climbed on my fire and hit the starter. Soon I rolled up in front of Rocky's place and backed my bike to the curb. Everything looked normal. I glanced down the street and saw the ATF van with my backup team sitting at the ready. Mustering my composure, I walked to Rocky's door, took a deep breath, reached in my pocket, and gripped my revolver. With my left hand, I knocked on the door. I could hear footsteps inside. As I had been trained in the ATF National Academy, I got into a modified weaver stance, turning sideways, feet shoulder-width apart, left foot slightly forward for balance, making my body a more narrow target. Adrenaline pumped through me and fired my heart into overdrive. The door began to creak open as I tightened up on my revolver. It was Vicky, Rocky's wife. Plan B, Plan B, Plan B. She smiled and opened the door. I smiled back. I knew that Rocky wouldn't be planning a murder in front of her. What the hell was going on? Rocky came stumbling from the back bedroom, more disheveled than usual, eyes glassy and unfocused. He was stoned out of his mind. He'd been up all night juicing and God knows what else. No wonder he'd been talking like he was pumped full of sodium pentothal. He walked toward me and gave me a big, clumsy hug. "We're gonna go get your patch. I talked with Mother last night and arranged it all," he said, referring to leadership in the Mongols' Mother chapter. "Luna keeps all the colors and he lives down in Commerce. We gotta go down there and pick it up. But we gotta go see Bobby Loco first, bro. He's handling your background check now." From an investigative standpoint, the most valuable aspect of prospecting was the vantage it gave me on Mongol drug dealing activity. On July 4, 1998, I got my first order from Rocky to pick up an 8-ball, 1/8 of an ounce, of meth, and deliver it to one of his clients. I ended up making several other drug transactions for Rocky that day. Shortly thereafter, at an official Mongol meeting, the question came up about using prospects to mule drugs for the gang. It was okayed by the club hierarchy, and I was positioned to be the full-time drug hauler for the Mongols. That summer I did 3 more drug runs and 1 gun run for the club before Domingo put a stop to it. He said he didn't like the idea that his only prospect was going to be the fall guy for the entire club in the event of a police bust, and he put the kibosh on my days as a drug mule. From then on, the SFV Mongols tended to rely on their old ladies or other hangarounds to carry out drug muling duties. I remained the SFV chapter's only prospect until Buster showed up. I have no idea where he came from. I just remember being glad that he was around to take some of the heat off of me. Buster was in his mid-20s, a bit on the raggedy side, with long black hair. No tattoos or tough guy presence, but he did ride a Harley that needed a little TLC, which fit right in with the busted-up bikes owned by most of the Mongols in our chapter. Domingo had brought Buster in and planned to sponsor him the way he was sponsoring me. The first big test for Buster would be Domingo's wedding and reception. The wedding was planned for a Saturday, and the prospect's duties would start early that day. There would be a shitload of Mongols there, which meant a shitload of prospecting to do. Domingo's wedding was held at the residence of a Mongol's associate named Randall. He was a successful businessman, but also a bit of a renegade. He had just enough sense to run a business, but not enough to know better than to hang out with the Mongols. And the Mongols enjoyed the guy, because he always had enough cocaine to share. He lived just outside Tujunga, in a sprawling ranch-style home on top of a large hill. It had a separate party house with a full bar, a pool table, a dance area, and a swimming pool. The driveway up the hill was approximately a quarter mile long, a quarter mile that I would become intimately familiar with before the night was out. By 9 in the morning, I was running around Tujunga picking up crap for the wedding, carrying tables and chairs and setting up beer stands. I was glad to see Buster, since it would be convenient having another prospect around to share the workload and the abuse. When evening arrived, I checked my Mongol ditty bag to be sure I had anything and everything a Mongol might hound me for. Matches, cigarettes, needle and thread, aspirin, breath mints and gum, rolling papers, condoms, a knife, a comb. I was as ready as I could be for whatever they might throw my way. I wondered if Buster had his shit together. At approximately 6, the first Mongols arrived, and before long, Buster and I were running our asses off. Then the peace was shattered, along with my nerves, by the appearance of Red Dog. Now I had to start ducking and dodging. He tracked me down in short order and made sure I knew that he was going to make my night as hellish as he could. Soon I was assigned to guard duty at the bottom of the hill. My orders from Domingo were, "No one except Mongols gets in without permission." He passed me a small snub-nosed .38, and I hustled down the hill. At the bottom, I found Rocky and Buster. Buster was also given a gun and instructed to use it if anyone, including the cops, tried to crash the party. I knew that I wasn't going to shoot anyone. By the expression on Buster's face, I didn't think he was going to shoot anyone either. He looked like he didn't know what to do with the gun. He finally stuck it in his waistband underneath his prospect patch. It didn't take long for the Mongols to realize that their only 2 prospects were standing guard at the bottom of the hill, leaving 50 or 60 of them without slave service. I could hear the call from a quarter mile away. "Prospect!" I told Buster to hang in, and I hustled back up the hill. Out of breath when I got there, I was directed to the main house, where all the Mongol bigwigs were hanging out. When I walked in, I saw the national officers with presidents from several chapters and a few regular-looking folks I had never seen before. A large silver platter holding lines of cocaine was being passed around. Red Dog had his face buried in it the moment I walked in. Domingo walked up to me and pointed out the 2 people who were obviously not Mongols. "Billy, that's our attorney, and you know who the other guy is, right?" Domingo stood shaking his head at my ignorance. "The other guy is our private investigator." My heart felt like it had burst. So this was the guy who'd been doing background checks on me for the past few months. Had they called me in to let me know that Tucker had found out who I really was? Did I just walk into a fucking Mongol ambush? Red Dog passed the Coke platter and caught a glimpse of me out of the corner of his eye. I knew some snide-assed comment or command would follow when I got ready. The next thing I heard from him was, "What the fuck you standing around for, prospect? Go get us some beer." That suited me. I wanted to be as far away from Red Dog as I could get. I turned and left the house, making my way toward one of the stashes of beer. All I could hear was simultaneous barks of, "Prospect! Prospect! Prospect!" I ran my ass off for a couple more hours before I heard Domingo ordering, "Prospect, go down the hill and take guard duty for a while. Send Buster up." High time. Down the hill I went, considerably more slowly this time. When I reached the bottom, I approached Buster. He looked like an army grunt, a baby-faced kid his first night out on the perimeter in Vietnam. "Buster, bad news," I said. He stared sheepishly at me like he couldn't possibly handle any more bad news right now. "Relax, bud. They just want you up the hill." Buster pulled his gun out and started to give it to me. "Nah, dude," I said. "Hang on to it. You might need it." I was just fucking with him, but Buster nodded solemnly. He tucked away the revolver and headed up the hill. An hour later, I saw Buster making his slow retreat back down, looking like he'd been ridden hard and was ready to crack. But it wasn't anywhere near quitting time. It was time to take my butt back up the hill for another round of abuse. The Mongols still had plenty of partying to do. I made my way back to the festivities, moving more slowly each time I had to climb that hill. As I reached the party, the first Mongol I walked past was Red Dog. Suddenly, I felt a thud from his fist hitting me in the chest. He grabbed my shirt and pulled me close to him. "I better see you working your ass off, Billy," he barked. "You need something, Red Dog?" I asked. "Yeah, go get me another beer." At around 4 o'clock, Domingo told me to hurry back down the hill. "Billy, go get your car. You're gonna take me and my new bride home." Although my legs were rubbery with fatigue, I made another jog down the hill to my car. Buster looked more nervous than a kitten in a pit bull arena. But there was no time for conversation with my prospect buddy. I blew by him and jumped into my Mustang. It was a great feeling not having to run back up that goddamn hill. Domingo and his drunken old lady were waiting when I got there. They piled into the car, and away we went. It was only a 10-minute drive back to Domingo's house. I was already seeing visions of my bed when Domingo turned and said something that hit me like ice water. "Soon as the old lady goes to sleep, we're headed back to the party." I lay down on Domingo's couch and just waited for him to kick me off so I could take him back to the party. To my relief, I heard a noise that I never thought I'd enjoy so much. Domingo was snoring his ass off. There'd be no more hill climbing for me that night. A few days later, I got a frantic call from Buster. He wanted to meet me at the place as soon as I could get there. After calling Chacon, I jumped on my bike and headed for Tujunga. When I rolled up, Buster was pacing back and forth like a caged tiger. "Billy, I can't do it." "Do what?" "I just can't do it, Billy. They're going to want me to shoot somebody, and I'm not going to be able to do it. I want out, Billy. Shit! I didn't know what I was getting into." In his near frantic state, Buster kept asking me what he should do. "Look, dude, I don't know. You're going to have to run it by Domingo. Just go tell him what you told me." He stared at me for a long minute and then pleaded, "Go with me, Billy, please." "Okay." Buster was scared as hell, and so was I. But he wanted out of the Mongols, and he was going to get out no matter what it cost him. We got on our bikes and headed for Domingo's. I honestly didn't know how we would react to this news. I couldn't even begin to guess. We arrived at Domingo's at around 1 p.m., I knocked on the door several times before I heard our chapter president yelling angrily, "Okay, I'm coming!" When he opened the door, it was obvious we had gotten him out of bed. Not a good start. "What's up, guys?" Buster didn't speak. I stared at him impatiently. Domingo stared at him impatiently. Finally, he found the courage he needed. I can't do it, Domingo. I want out. I didn't know what I was getting into. Again, there was a long silence. Suddenly, Domingo grabbed my shirt, pulling me close to him and choking me. Does that shit go for you too, Billy? No, man. I'm hanging. Now Domingo began to vent at Buster. I brought you in, you fucking bastard. I sponsored you. I looked after you, and this is what I get. I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry. Buster was stammering and spitting now. He asked Domingo what he could do to make things right. Domingo shook him off, saying it wasn't going to be that easy, that he'd decided church that evening. Then he told us to get the hell out of his house. When we got back to the place, we drank a few beers, and Buster kept staring at me like a frightened deer, asking me over and over what I thought he should do. I told him that maybe he should pack his bags and leave town tonight. He said he couldn't do that. His whole family lived in the area, and he was afraid the Mongols would go after them. It was a valid concern. I told him that the only thing he could do was to face the music. He had about 3.5 hours before church to think about the direction his life was going to take. 3.5 torturous hours. Church was held at Buckethead's place in Sunland. I rolled in a few minutes before 5, and Buster pulled up in his car shortly thereafter. I stayed outside like a good prospect, talking with Buster, trying to keep him calm. I told Buster that if the Mongols wanted me to beat him up, that I would hit him once and he should go down. He should cover his head and face, and I would kick him in the stomach rather than breaking his nose, loosening his teeth, or giving him a concussion. Buster began to thank me. Somehow, orchestrating his beating made us both feel a little better. At last, Domingo yelled from inside the house for me, "Prospect Billy!" I looked at Buster, then walked inside. Domingo, Rancid, Buckethead, and Rocky were all sitting around the table. In the center of the table lay a .38 caliber revolver. Domingo thanked me for hanging in with the Mongols, and so did Rocky. Then Domingo floored me with their decision. If Buster wanted out, he would have to play Russian roulette. "There's one bullet in the gun," Domingo said. "He's gonna put that gun to his head, pull the trigger, and if he doesn't blow his brains out, then he's out of the club." Domingo told me to send Buster in. As I turned to walk away, I knew I'd have to tell Buster to run. There wasn't a choice. I couldn't aid and abet in this poor kid's Mongol-ordered suicide. But before I could open my mouth to warn Buster, I saw Domingo following me out. He pointed at Buster and said one word, "In." Buster ambled forward like a tethered cow to the slaughterhouse. Domingo held the door and Buster passed through. I watched the door slam shut behind him. I stood with my back to the wall and heard myself praying for Buster. "Oh God, oh Jesus, oh God." I began pacing, waiting to hear a gunshot from inside. Suddenly, Buster emerged from inside the house. I wanted to hug him, take him back to the place, drown him in beer. I smiled at Buster, but he didn't look back. He stared straight ahead and walked past. He looked as though he'd just been sitting face to face with the devil himself, gambling over his soul. Without a word, he got in his car and drove away. I never saw Buster again. Chapter 8. It had been another Mongol all-nighter. I'd watched the sunrise with the SFV chapter and had just fallen asleep in my UC apartment at around 9 a.m. An hour later, the phone jolted me half back to life. It was Chacon. "I need you to come in, Bill. The SAC said he's going to shut down the fucking investigation. We've got a meeting right after lunch." This news was more ominous to me than to Chacon. Not because I had been risking my life for the last 5 months, or because we had so much tied up in this investigation, but because I had been through this before with the Los Angeles Division. Chacon, ever the good soldier, was ready to take on the SAC, the ASAC, or anyone else who threatened the well-being of the investigation. It was just another battle to John, but to me, it signified serious trouble. I was aware that this might be not just another run-of-the-mill bureaucratic battle, but our Waterloo. Before getting involved in the Mongols case, I had worked undercover for Special Agent John Jakes in one of the most extensive and complex operations ATF had yet attempted. We purchased one fully automatic 30mm cannon from an arms smuggler and had an order in for four more. We desperately needed to jam this guy and his whole operation. He'd already sold one of the cannons to some anti-government thug up in Washington State. Seeing such armaments in the hands of people willing to sell to the highest bidder was scary enough. But then the smuggler offered to sell me a fully armed Cobra helicopter gunship. This would have been one of the most significant seizures in ATF history. We submitted the plans along with a mountain of paperwork to the SAC and prepared to put the operation into play. But the SAC responded with an absolutely stunning order. Shut the investigation down. I was speechless. I argued with the SAC. I told them that there was already a fully automatic 30mm cannon out there in the hands of some asshole who hated Uncle Sam and everything he stood for. There were smugglers bringing major military armaments into the country. We had U.S. Customs on board with us. As a matter of fact, Customs was willing to furnish the money to buy the Cobra. The Los Angeles SAC's response to all our pleading was an unconditional no. End of story, he said. Shut it down. Against the advice of his RAC, senior customs officials, and even his own intelligence personnel, the Los Angeles SAC did shut the undercover investigation down. All he could do was walk out of his office in shock and disbelief, letting a once-in-a-lifetime international arms smuggling investigation wither into just another unremarkable gun buy. It was a Friday, 1 p.m. Chacon and I were in a downtown Los Angeles office, staring at a room full of suits. Dick Curd, the Los Angeles special agent in charge, John Torres, the assistant special agent in charge, and Tom Brandon, the group resident agent in charge. Both Curd and Torres had an agenda that was somewhat less than conducive to the success of our complex investigation. Dick Curd was nearing the end of his career with ATF, and, from my perspective, wanted to cruise for the remainder of his term as SAC. His young assistant, John Torres, was an administrative climber, and not rocking the boat was the way up in the Bureau. Torres knew that deep undercover operations presented potentially career-ending decisions. Operations like this involved laying out large quantities of money, obtaining electronic surveillance, sending vast amounts of paperwork up the chain of command. Our operation, due to its scope and importance, would be monitored in Washington, D.C. by the top officials in ATF and the Treasury Department. There was no way that Curd and Torres wanted any part of a monitored investigation like that. As we sat down for the meeting, there were smiles and pleasantries all around, but I felt like I was in a used car salesman's cubicle. Chacon leaned over and whispered in my ear, "Don't say anything, not a word." Tom Brandon, who shared Chacon's and my ambitions for the case, opened the meeting with a background synopsis of the Mongols' investigation. As I watched his presentation, I realized just how remarkable it was that we had gotten as far as we had. We'd accomplished everything that we'd said we were going to accomplish. I'd actually gotten my bottom rocker and was an official prospect for the Mongols' Motorcycle Club. Every aspect of the investigation was where it was projected to be at this point. I'd gathered evidence of the Mongols trafficking in methamphetamine and cocaine, witnessed them in possession of stolen motorcycles and assault rifles, and was confident that, given time, I could make some major drug and gun buys from them. As if he had not heard one word of Brandon's presentation, the SAC said, "I've decided to shut the investigation down." But Brandon, a former United States Marine, was no pushover. His face turned crimson. He began to argue vehemently with Curd and Torres. The SAC and ASAC were taken aback. If Curd was going to shut down the investigation, Brandon said, he wanted to see it all in writing. He wanted it clearly documented for everyone in the ATF chain of command, from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C., Curd wasn't going to be able to shut this one down for no reason without showing the entire Bureau what he'd done and having to answer for it down the line. There was a long pause. Chacon and I glanced at each other, unsure how this outburst was going to play. Then Kurt quickly backpedaled.
Well, okay, I'll give it some more thought, he said. But as of right now, the investigation is shut down. Queen's not to go back under until I've made my final decision.
I remembered Chacon's warning to keep my mouth shut. Instead of blowing my cool, I leaned over to John's ear and whispered, That's not gonna work. I'm prospecting. I gotta be there tonight or I'll be looking at a Royal Mongol ass-whipping. At the very least.
Chacon told Kurd that in the prospect stage, I had to be present to serve the Mongols' membership every night of the week. There were no exceptions.
The sack looked at Chacon and said,
Well, he can just tell the Mongols he was out with some bimbo.
It was obvious that Kurd had no clue what outlaw motorcycle gangs were all about, that he couldn't fathom the risk I was placed in or the magnitude of this investigation.
Chacon and Brandon attempted to explain the gravity of my situation to Kurd and Torres. All the while, I sat biting my tongue. At the minimum, Chacon explained, I'd be physically beaten, quite possibly severely, if I didn't show up this weekend.
If Queen doesn't have his backstops in place, the sack said with a shrug, then shame on him. This meeting is over.
Brandon, Chacon, and I got up and left the office. Chacon and I knew what we had to do. Following the sack's direct order was not an option. Fuck him. I left downtown L.A. and went home to my undercover apartment, did a little mechanical work on my Harley, and got ready for another night out with the Mongols. We've been put in the paradoxical position of disobeying a superior's direct order in order to do our jobs properly. Being a stand-up guy, Tom Brandon paged Dick Kurd in an effort to make things right. The sack didn't return the call. Chacon and I didn't mention anything to Brandon about what we knew we had to do. We just did it. To keep the operation alive, I knew I had to start showing some tangible results, get some irrefutable evidence on the Mongols so that the stream of reports heading to Washington showed our level of progress. We knew that the club was engaged in a variety of violent crimes, but the hard evidence was always hard to come by. As luck would have it, not long after I'd earned my center patch, the Mongols made a run to Phoenix to christen the newly established Arizona chapter. The mother chapter in Commerce had issued an order that the Arizona run was mandatory for all California Mongols. It was going to be a tough run for the SFV chapter. Even among bikers, these guys were a bunch of misfits. At the time, I had the only bike in the chapter that actually ran for more than 20 miles at a stretch. Domingo had just sold his late model Sportster to keep it from being repossessed by Harley Davidson. That left him riding a bike taken by force from a member who'd recently been thrown out of the gang. Acquiring an ex-member's motorcycle is common practice in outlaw motorcycle gangs. A member kicked out in bad standing loses almost all his worldly possessions to the gang, sometimes even his woman, who, in the outlaw universe, of course, is just another object in the inventory of his property. Rocky would be riding his piece-of-shit Harley, which was both stolen and mechanically questionable. Rancid owned an older, rigid frame shovel head, open primary with ape hanger handlebars tall enough to make him look like he was damn near standing up while he rode. Buckethead would be on an equally ragged panhead that he'd put together in his backyard a couple of hours before the trip. God knows, we were going to need a flatbed truck to pick up the bike remnants falling off our convoy along the way. Although I was an official Mongol prospect, I was never trusted with any more details than I needed. I vaguely knew we were going to Arizona, but wasn't told the specifics of the run. I'd have to be a good, obedient Mongol prospect and fall in at the back of the pack, keep up, hang on. Chacon and the boys on backup duty would just have to shadow the run. I was to meet up with the SFV chapter at a McDonald's off the San Bernardino Freeway at the Fairplex exit in Pomona at 7 p.m. As a prospect, you don't dare show up late. I was in the parking lot at 20 to 7. It was dark as I sat there wondering if the SFV chapter was going to show up at all. It could well have been some prospect hoop they wanted me to jump through simply for their entertainment pleasure.
I heard one pack of bikes after another pass by. I knew that there were Mongols from other chapters headed for Arizona. I was just about to call Chacon to see if he had any word as to the fate of my distinguished SFV brethren when the pitiful bunch rolled into the parking lot, bikes roaring and belching smoke. No one shut down their engines for fear they wouldn't get them started again. Plus, we were already an hour and a half late. We headed out, and I assumed my assigned position at the rear of the pack. To my surprise, we made it all the way to Palm Springs exit without anyone breaking down. Then Rancid went to downshift, only to find that his shift lever had separated from the bike sometime in the last 100 miles. I was certain he'd been too high to remember to tighten it back on. Rancid limped his bike to a service station. No sooner had we parked our motorcycles at the gas station than someone yelled, "Prospect!" I was ordered to find the nearest 7-Eleven and pick up some Budweiser. First things first under these trying circumstances. When I returned from my beer run, Rancid dropped down to one knee next to my bike. "Prospect," he said, "take the back shift lever off your bike." Unlike his bike, mine had a front and rear shift lever. This allowed me to shift gears using my toe or my heel. My companions had apparently decided that I only needed one. I knelt down and began taking apart my bike. I knew I'd never get the lever back. Everyone carried a sufficient quantity of tools, which was prudent considering the frequent disrepair of the bikes. Getting the lever off was an easy task, and in no time at all, Rancid's bike sported a new shift lever complements of the ATF. After downing our beer and gassing up, we left for Arizona. Although it was dark, I had no problem seeing or smelling the smoke from the bikes in front of me. 50 miles flew by, 60 miles, then 70, then boom! Buckethead's engine blew like a hand grenade. Off the highway and onto the shoulder we went. It couldn't have happened at a more convenient place, 70 miles from the middle of nowhere, right next to 2 miles of guardrail. We had only 4 or 5 feet to work in, and 50,000 pounds of speeding 18-wheel tractor trailers were constantly blowing by at 85 miles per hour. Buckethead's rear piston, what was left of it anyway, was sticking completely out of the crankcase. The prognosis was grim, probably terminal. But how to get the shell of a bike off the highway? We decided Buckethead would take my bike and ride back to the nearest phone. He'd have his old lady come out from the valley with his pickup truck. That should only take about 2 or 3 hours. As a prospect, I had no vote in the proposed plan, so Buckethead took off on my bike, and the rest of the SFV chapter settled in for a night of highway camping. The temperature was dipping below 50, but it was a beautiful desert night with a star-filled sky. As I lay under a guardrail, I enviously wondered what motel Chacon and the backup boys were in right now. I had conjured up all kinds of scenarios for what might happen during this Arizona operation. But spending the night on the side of an interstate in the middle of the desert wasn't one of them. Buckethead didn't return until about 6 o'clock the next morning. Domingo was furious and didn't waste any time jumping into Buckethead's shit. Buckethead's tale of woe was that by the time he'd actually gotten hold of his old lady, it was somewhere around 2 in the morning, so he decided to just spend a few hours lying around at the service station where he stopped to call. Domingo was pissed off and decided to leave Buckethead behind, but someone was going to have to stay with him and help load his bike into the back of the pickup his old lady was bringing out. Guess who? The plan was for Domingo, Rocky, and Rancid to ride to Arizona while I stayed with Buckethead and helped load the bike. To my surprise, some 2 hours later, Buckethead's old lady actually showed up. Buckethead and I wrestled the bike into the back of the truck. I got ready to start up my bike so we could continue our trek, but Buckethead decided he didn't like the way Domingo had gotten in his face, and he decided to take his old lady, his truck, and his dead panhead motorcycle back to L.A. and pass on Arizona altogether. I would have to ride the rest of the way alone. Buckethead gave me a map showing the way to the motel in Phoenix where the Mongols would be staying. Phoenix? I'd never been told our exact destination in Arizona, but Chacon was sure that we were going to Four Corners. Not only had I wasted a day and spent a night not fit for a desert coyote, but now I was on my own in the middle of nowhere with my ATF backup on their way to a completely different destination. Arizona was Hell's Angels territory. A lone biker wearing a Mongol prospect patch here was going to be risky business. I had to get to the nearest payphone to let Chacon know that the run was headed for Phoenix. I stopped at the first service station I came to. Chacon actually answered his cell phone. It was obvious that my call had awakened him. He and the boys had made it to Flagstaff, Arizona, before they decided to find a motel and call it a night. "Guess what, old buddy? The run's going to Phoenix, not Four Corners." "Shit!" I gave Chacon directions to the motel in Phoenix and a brief rundown of my night with the guys, and then I headed out. As I reached the Phoenix city limit, I caught up to Domingo and the boys. They were on the side of the road, loading Domingo's broken-down bike in the back of a trailer the Mongols had had to rent as soon as they hit Phoenix. Well, at least I was going to be riding into town with a pack of sorts. It must have been about 10 in the morning when what was left of the SFV chapter rolled into the parking lot of the Quality Inn. I was dead tired, but there would be no sleep for me. I was immediately assigned guard duty in the hallway where the Mongols' national officers were sleeping. It reminded me of the times when I'd been ordered by ATF to back up the Secret Service, except that when pulling Secret Service duty, you knew you were going to be relieved like clockwork in an hour. Here, I was just hoping to be relieved before I fell asleep in my motorcycle boots. Somewhere around 1 o'clock that afternoon, the national officers decided to get out of bed for something to eat. Finally, Domingo took pity on me and sent me to the room to get some sleep. When I got there, I found Rancid curled up, fast asleep, on the only bed. He was snoring at the same decibel level at which his hog idled. But I was too tired to see any humor in it. I took my appointed place on the floor and fell right asleep. Rancid got up around 4 p.m., agitated that I was sleeping and not out prospecting as he felt I should be. I woke up to find him kicking me in the back and screaming, "Prospect, get your lazy ass up and go across the street and get us a pint of Jack Daniels." Like a punch-drunk fighter, I stumbled to my feet. I was feeling way too old for this shit. Fueled by crank, these guys thought nothing of partying for 3 days straight, catching 2 hours of sleep, doing more crank, and then running for another 3 days. It was standard operating procedure for a Mongol on meth. At least I didn't have to worry about taking a shower, changing clothes, or brushing my teeth.
End of disc 3.